I just wanted to mention before we begin the shir this evening, Baruch Hashem, happy to report that the Pesach Haggadah has been reprinted, the Darkness to Destiny Haggadah, which some of you may have. Looks like this. Everything you could want in a Pesach Haggadah goes with all forms of interior decor and is entirely kosher to Pesach. So, it's available in stores, Pomerantz, and others, and also online, I think, in some locations. So please look out for that.
Darkness to Destiny?
That's the one.
It's cool.
That's the one. And we begin our deliberations in Parshas Tazria. And of course, Parshas Tazria has at its center, one could say, the matter of Tzaras, which we will get to soon, Imrit Hashem. But Tazria starts with something else, and that is what's known as the Korban Yoledes. When a woman has a child, bears a child, so there are certain korbanos to bring. Nowadays we don't have that. I think newborn mothers, neonatal, feel that they are have enough to deal with, and indeed they do. But in the time of the Beis Hamikdash, there was one more thing, and that is to bring korbanos. And there are two korbanos that are brought, and they are outlined in Psukim Vav and Ches of Perik Yud Beis. What are the korbanos? One is an ola, a burnt offering entirely, and one is a chatos, a sin offering. And there's much discussion from Chazal and Mefarshim. Why should she bring an ola, a burnt offering? Why should she bring a chatos, a sin offering? But our discussion will revolve this evening about what are those korbanos. So interestingly, it depends. Korban yoledes, the korbanos that the mother brings, is in the category of what we call ole v'yored. That is to say, it depends on the financial status of the woman or of her husband. If she can afford it, there's a certain set of korbanos. If that's difficult or inaccessible for her financially, a second set. What is the korbanos if she can afford it? Pasuk Vav, Uvim Laos Yemei Tahara, at the end of her days of Tara, Tavi Keves Ben Shenoso Laola, she brings a keves, a lamb, for an ola, the burnt offering, Uben Yona Otor Lachatos, and the dove or the pigeon for a chatos. So if she can afford it, it's an animal for a korban, the lamb, and a bird for a chatos, the sin offering. But then Pasuk Ches says, V'im lo timtzayada deseh. But what if she can't afford to bring an animal? V'lakash deserim. So then the two korbanos take the form of two birds, two dirtle doves, two pigeons, Echad le'ola ve'echad le'chatos, one for an ola, one for a chatos. So that's the situation. Two korbanos. The first, one for an ola, one for a chatos. And Rashi has a comment on Pasuk Ches. And let's take a look at this comment of Rashi. Echad le'ola ve'echad le'chatos, one for a burnt offering, one for a sin offering. Says Rashi, you should know, Lo hikdima hakosuv ela lemikra'a. Ola is mentioned first only lemikra'a, for purposes of reading. When you read the verse, you'll read ola first. Aval lahakrova, when it comes to actually bringing the korbanos, chatos kodemes laola. The chatos comes before the ola. Kach sheninu bezvachim. Thus we have learned in Maseches Zvachim in Daf Tzadik. So Rashi's informing us that although the verse mentions the ola before the chatos, in practice, the chatos would be brought first. Okay. Mefarshei Rashi, as we often see, are laying very heavy emphasis and paying very close attention to everything about Rashi. And the first question that they ask is, as we prefaced, there are two verses which outline the korbanos of this woman. Pasuk Vav, if she can afford it, and Pasuk Ches, if not. Why would Rashi only make this comment about the Chatas being brought first in the second verse? It happens to be that the exact same halacha is true if she takes the program in verse 6 in Pasuk Vav. If she brings an animal for an Ola and a bird for a Chatas, the Chatas is brought first. Animal is mentioned first, the Ola, but the Chatas is brought first. Rashi, as we know, will never forego an opportunity to make a pertinent comment if it presents itself. He won't wait for the second time. Why here did Rashi wait for the second time? Pasuk Ches. What's more, it actually is a bigger chiddush. It's more news in verse 6 for the simple reason that in Pasuk Vav, the Ola is an animal. The Chatos is a bird. There's that discrepancy. An animal is more significant than a bird. And therefore, we may have thought that there, perhaps, the Ola comes first because it's an animal. And even there, it's not true. Even there, when the Ola is an animal, the Chatos bird comes first. So that's a bigger chiddush than if they're both birds, to say the Chatos bird comes before the Ola bird. And this, very simply, is a question which Mefarshei Rashi will always ask. If he comments at a later opportunity, why did he forego the earlier opportunity? And actually, this rolls into a second question on this Rashi. Namely, why is Rashi making this comment at all? Let us remind ourselves, Rashi's goal, his stated mission in his commentary on the Torah is Liyashev Pshuta Shel Mikra, to resolve Pshat issues in the verse. Now, it happens to be that when it comes to this verse, if you know the halacha, you will know that the Ola is mentioned first, but the Chatas is brought first. If you know the halacha, you'll know that. But if you don't, then you won't. Rashi's job in his commentary on the Torah is not to inform us of the relevant halachas. It's to explain the relevant verses. What is there about any of these verses that required Rashi to get involved in this halachic discussion? Those are the two major questions with regards to this comment on Rashi. And who comes in to help us, if not the Maskila David, Rabbi David Pardo, one of the great commentators on Rashi from the 1700s. And he explains that, in fact, Rashi is bothered by something in the verse. Because if we look again at Pasuk Ches, verse 8, it says, if she cannot afford to bring an animal for an Ola, so v'lokcha shtei sorim o shnei b'nei Yona, she should take two doves, echad le'ola, one for an Ola, ve'echad le'chatos, and one for a chatos. Says the Maskila David, that is a problematic phraseology. Why? Because if we consider elsewhere, and a classic example would be the two daily korbanos that we bring, the tamid, the morning and the afternoon. There it says, es hakeves, well-known psukim, es hakeves echad ta'aseh baboker, the one is brought in the morning, ve es hakeves hasheni ta'aseh ben harbayim, the one in the morning and the second in the afternoon. When the pasuk deals with two things, it will call the first one echad and the second one sheni. And with that in mind, come back to our pasuk, and you have two korbanos, the ola and the chatos. And the ola is called echad, and the chatos is called echad. They're both firsts, but they're not, because the second is the second. So why does it say echad le'ola, the echad le'chatos, and not echad le'ola, the hasheni le'chatos? That's par for the course. And that is why Rashi brings in this halachic comment from the Gemara. Why? To explain how both the ola and the chatos are echad. They are both first, each one in a different way, each one in a different arena. In terms of what's mentioned first in the pasuk, the ola is echad, but the chatos is also echad. because practically the chatos is brought first. And that is why Rashi brings in this Gemara to explain how both korbanos are called echad, one for the reading and one for the offering. And moreover, says Maskila David, once we understand that this is what Rashi is coming to resolve, we will also understand why Rashi didn't make this comment in the earlier verse. Because in the earlier verse, you didn't have two of a kind. The earlier verse, the ola is an animal. The chatas is a bird. So there is no two of anything that to even speak about echad this and echad that. It says the animals are the ola and the bird is the chatas. So with no mention of echad at all, Rashi did not feel the need to get engaged to tell you that the chatas comes first. It's only the second time round, when they're both of the same kind, and the pasuk begins to employ the terminology of echad and echad, one and one, first and first, that Rashi makes this comment. So very elegant explanation indeed of the Maskila David, and to remind us, as we don't need reminding, but we always appreciate being reminded, the attention that every comment of Rashi deserves. What did he say? Why did he say it? Where did he say it? But if we move now, legufo shel inyan, to ask the question, perhaps a balabatisha question. If the chatas is always offered first, so why is it not mentioned first? Why does the pasuk mention the ola first? All right. I would say first come, first serve. So why is it that in the verse the ola comes first? What do we mean when we say when you read it, you'll read about the ola first? And Mefarshim explain. We have two experiences of korbanos. One is practical and one is verbal. That is to say, when the Beis HaMikdash is standing, we can bring the korbanos practically. But when the Beis HaMikdash is not standing, we have a concept whereby we speak about the korbanos, and it is considered in part as if we have offered the korban. That's the famous Gemara in Maseches Megillah and Tanis, that Hashem told Avram his descendants would inherit the land of Israel in the merit of korbanos. And Avram asks, but what if there is no Beis HaMikdash? Then, says HaKadosh Baruch Hu, let them speak about the korbanos, and that will be a partial fulfillment. So these are the two planes of engagement for us with korbanos, the practical and the verbal. Well, in practical terms, the chatas is brought first. And why? Because the chatas has more mitzvahs associated with it. Part of it is brought on the mizbeach, but part of it is consumed by the kohanim. And therefore, because it has a broader spread of mitzvahs, it takes precedence over the ola, because the ola only has one plane of involvement, the offering on the mizbeach. So the chatas has more mitzvahs, it comes first. But that's only when the korbanos are actually being brought. But when they're not being brought, and when we speak about them, it happens to be that our discussion of the ola is more complete than our discussion of the chatas. Why? Because we'll appreciate that the concept that speaking about korbanos is like offering them relates solely to the realm of the offering of the korban. It doesn't relate to the consumption of the korban. No one would ever say, if you talk about eating a chatas, it's like you ate a chatas. And therefore, in terms of what we're able to supply through our words, it's purely the realm of offering the korban. And that's why when we speak about them, the ola takes precedence. Because the ola is entirely represented by our words. The ola was entirely offered, and our words are entirely like an offering. As opposed to a chatas, where it is only partially represented, because only the part that is offered on the mizbeach can be accounted for or represented by talking about the chatas. And that's why when we speak about them, the ola comes first. Food for thought. It is interesting to see how this idea resonates in our the nusach of our tefillah. We say in the Musaf of the Yomim Tovin, when we ask for the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash, and we say, V'sham na'aseh lefanecha korbanos chavoseinu, and there we will offer the korbanos, tamidim kisidram, umusafim kihilchasam. Translated, tamidim in their order, musafim as per their halachas. That's a well-known refrain from the Musaf. And let's ask a simple question. What did we just say? We'd like to offer the Tamidim in their order. We'd like to offer the Musaf in accordance with their halachas. Last I checked, I should think that we'd like to offer all korbanos in accordance with their halachas. It's halachic Judaism. Where are you going to practice the halachas if not in the Beis HaMikdash? So we say, when it comes to the Tamid, well, but offer them in order. When it comes to them, to the Musaf, we'd like to do that halachically. Why do we only mention the concept of kihilchatam with regards to the Musafim? It's a good shaila. Says Rabbi Tzalel HaKohen of Vilna, what we mean to say is that when it comes to the Musaf, the halacha happens to be that the chatas is always mentioned at the end of the Musaf offerings. Isn't that so? We say however many parim, elim, kevosim, etc., etc., and we always end off, and a goat for a chatas. Usi'irizim chata, it's always mentioned at the end. But even there, the halacha is that the chatas is brought first. That is the difference between the tamid offering and the Musaf offering. The Talmud offering is offered in the order that it is spoken about in the Pasuk. The Pasuk says, Keves Echad in the morning, Keves Hasheni Bein Ha'arbayim. And that we would like to do Kisidram, in the order that they are mentioned in the Pasuk. Musafim are not Kisidram. They will not be offered in the order that they're mentioned in the Pasuk, because the Pasuk mentions the chatas last, but it's poured first. That's the halacha. And that's why, unlike tamidim, which are kisidram, we ask to bring musafim kehilchasam, as the halacha determines the order. So says Rabbi Tzalel HaKohen Mivilna. Always valuable to see how the halachas that we learn, and the ideas that we learn, how they are expressed in the tefillah. And the truth of the matter is, it goes even further. Because in the chazan's repetition, where there's duchening, in the Chazan's repetition of the Musaf for Yom Tov, there's a section just before it say, "V'se'arev alecha asiraseinu ka'ola o ka'korba." May our entreaties rise before you like an ola and a korban, as if to say, we're davening Musaf, it should be like a korban. Honor Rachum, please, compassionate one. Hashev shchinascha letzioni recha, bring your divine presence back to Tzion. V'seder ha'avoda liYerushalayim, and the order of the avoda to Yerushalayim. What is behind the phraseology here? One of the greats of the late 1700s, Rav Farel HaKohen miHamburg. He's not someone that we quote from that much. He's a contemporary of Rav Chaim of Elazhen. He was the Rav of Hamburg, Altona, those communities, and he explains that. Here we are highlighting the difference between speaking about the korbanos and bringing the korbanos. The most we can ask for is that our entreaties should be like korbanos. But that's why when we say v'se'arev lefanech asiraseinu, we say ke'ola o ke'korban. We mention ola before other korbanos. Because when we speak about it, we speak about ola first, for reasons that we explained. But what we're asking for is the real thing, that the korbanos should be brought back. And when they're brought back, this will be most expressed in the reversal of the order of korbanos. We do not speak about the korbanos in the order that they're brought. And that's why we ask, when the divine presence comes back, also should come back seder ha'avoda liYerushalayim, the correct order, first the chatas and then others. So these are certainly very interesting things to think about. And, well, depending on who's chazan for Musaf, you often have a lot of time to think about these things. So it's good to have an insight into the nusach of the tefillah. So having spoken a little bit about Yes, wherever there's duchening, v'se'or, wherever there's duchening. On Yom Tov, correct, Musaf Yom Tov. Let's move to really the heart of the parsha, which is Tzaraas. And what I'd like to do, and what I found particularly fascinating this year, is that there are many aspects, I would say, of Tzaraas. We're familiar with them on an individual level. But to understand the picture that emerges when we bring them all together, that is something that is most worthwhile. And if we begin with a simple question, what is Tzaraas? By which I do not mean, although that's an important discussion as well, is Tzaraas leprosy? Is it? But what I mean is something else. What is the essence of Tzaraas? And to explain, Tzaraas has two aspects to it. If you go through the verses, you will see that Tzaraas has two aspects to it. The first aspect is that of nega, affliction. And in that respect, there are many afflictions that a person could have. Tzaraas is a certain type of affliction, and we assume that it was uncomfortable, depending on what it is, perhaps even very, very difficult physically to bear. It is called nega tzaraas, a plague or an affliction. It is in the realm of what we would call yisurim, of physical distress. At the same time, it is also a form of tumah, a form of contamination. Whoever the mitzvah touches becomes tamei. Whatever the mitzvah touches becomes tamei. So we have a very interesting confluence of two concepts, and they don't always go together. There's many types of suffering that have nothing to do with tumah, impurity. Most types of impurity have nothing to do with suffering. It's a question of coming into contact with something that made you tummy. And yet here they come together under the same roof. Nega tzaraas and tumas tzaraas. What is behind that joining, that fusion? But the truth of the matter is that even once we identify these two key elements within tzaraas, it's clear that tzaraas is more than both of them. For a very simple reason. The halacha states that if a person has tzaraas symptoms or tzaraas situation, he needs to follow the protocols and quarantine as set down by the Torah, as told to him by the Kohen. He cannot take any steps to remove the tzaraas affliction. And sometimes it could be removed physically, if it's a burn or a boil or whatever it could be. So that could be removed and then he's good as new. It is forbidden for a person to take their own steps and measures in removing the tzaraas affliction. And that already tells us that there is more to tzaraas than both affliction and impurity. Because in those two areas, we never find that it's forbidden for a person to take their own measures to alleviate their situation. Certainly, if a person has become tamei, they're entitled to get themselves out of that situation. They're entitled to purify themselves, maybe even encouraged to do so as soon as possible. No one ever said, if you're tamei, stay that way. And the same is true for other types of afflictions. Lo aleinu, if a person has a difficult affliction, he should assume that it's come to him for a reason. But the fact that it's come to him for a reason doesn't make it forbidden for him to try and remove it. According to many mefarshim, that's why the Torah says, with regards to illness and all these ailments, virapo yirape, he shall be healed, as the Pasuk says in Mishpatim, which the Gemara explains in Bava Kamma, mikan shenitna rishus larofa lerapos. Permission has been given to the doctor to heal. We might ask, why should the doctor need permission? Because one might think, if this has come to the person from heaven, heaven gave it, let heaven take it away. Maybe it's wrong to intervene. Maybe you're ruining everything. Maybe you're frustrating heaven's message. But we don't say that. One should get the message, but one should also get a prescription. The two go together. And yet, tzaraas is not that way. If for a person as tsaras, he cannot take steps to get himself out of that, which means that there's more to tsaras than both being impure and being uncomfortable or in distress. And what else could there be? The truth of the matter is that there are further unique features to tsaras, again, which we're all familiar. If a person has symptoms of tsaras, he needs to go to the Kohen. Only a Kohen can pronounce him as Tommy with tsaras. And let us ask, why? After all, if he's not sure whether this qualifies or is defined as a tsaras ailment, let him go to an expert. What if the expert is not a Kohen? What if he's an expert in tsaras? That's his field of expertise. He can't help you. He won't make a difference. You can only go to the Kohen. And sometimes, interestingly, as Mefarshim point out, what if the Kohen doesn't know? The Kohen himself might ask the expert. You could have done that. But you can't. The Kohen asks the expert, and the expert says, that's tsaras. And nothing's happened yet. And then the Kohen says, that's tsaras. And now you're a mitzvah. So why is the Kohen the only address for matters relating to tsaras? And what is most unusual about the whole tsaras situation is, and again, these are things that we know, when the Kohen pronounces a person a mitzvah, that person is a mitzvah from that point onwards, not retroactively. Even though he may have had the symptom for 3 days, and he may have come into contact with objects and people for the past 3 days, but he did not yet go to the Kohen. When the Kohen sees this as a tsaras case, so in other forms of tumah, impurity, we say, if it's been confirmed that this is tumah, so then from the time that you had these symptoms, you need to work backwards and understand that you were tummy all along. And yet when it comes to tsaras, it's not the case. You can have been roaming around in contact with everyone and anyone and anything. Nothing happened. From the moment the Kohen looks at you and says, that's tsaras, moving forward, now you're mitzora. All of this clearly makes for a very intriguing and unusual situation. And that is why one of the great mefarshim of our times, Reb Leib Mintzberg Zatzal, who we have quoted recently, passed away not too many years ago. In his Sefer Ben Melech, he explains, the closer you look, the more you see that something else is happening in the realm of tsaras. It may take the form of an affliction. It may have the effect of rendering a person impure. That may well be, but that's not what it is. What it is at heart is a person receiving a message of censure from heaven. These are symptoms. If a person is on the receiving end of these symptoms, he's received a message from heaven, and that message is something is chronically wrong and you need to be censured for it. And this is a completely different, I would say, halachic atmosphere. And it results in unique halachas for the mitzora. As we know, if a person is a confirmed case of tsaras, he needs to leave town. He's thrown out of town. What's that got to do with anything? Is that just to prevent him from contaminating others? He can stay at home, but he can't stay at home. He's run out of town almost. That's an act of censure. He's banished from the city. Something is chronically wrong with him, and that needs to be expressed, and he needs to leave town. And the truth is, there is a pasuk which describes the way that he needs to conduct himself during those days. It's in Perek Yud Gimel, pasuk Mem He. And what does the pasuk say? Once again, Perek Yud Gimel, pasuk Mem He. V'hatzarua ashebo hanega. The tsarua who has this affliction, how should he conduct himself? How should he comport himself? Begadav yihyu frumim. His clothes need to be rent. Rent, that is to say, torn. Veroshoye parua, and his hair needs to be unkempt, wild. Ve'al safam ya'ate, and he needs to cover his head until his mouth, that is to say, to cover his face practically. That's how he needs to act during these days of tzara'as. What are those forms of action? They are the acts of a person who has been censured. His clothing is torn. He doesn't take care of himself. His hair is unkempt. His face is covered. That's a person who has been censured by heaven. And the truth of the matter is that for those who know, and in fact it was in the Daf Yomi just recently, in Masechet Moed Katan, although for those who have started Masechet Yevamos, I don't know if they can really remember anything about life before Masechet Yevamos, but in Masechet Moed Katan, there are two sets of halachos which are almost identical, more than two in fact, but for our purposes. The third perek of Moed Katan describes the halachos of cherim. If a person has been put in cherim, how does he need to act? How should he dress? What are his guidelines? What are people's guidelines with him? And the halacha states he needs to act exactly the way the metzora acts. His face needs to be covered. His clothes should be torn. He's not allowed to shave, to cut his hair or trim his beard, etc. The halachas of a person who has been put in cherem, who has been censured by the Beis Din, are lifted directly from the halachas of Metzora. And that tells us, in no uncertain terms, that what is happening in the world of Metzora is he's been put in cherem. This is a message of cherem from heaven. And it's for this reason that the only one who can declare him a Metzora is a Kohen. Because it's not a question of asking an expert whether these are the signs. It's about checking in with someone who can give him a message from on high. And that is the Kohanim. The Kohanim represent us to Hashem. They represent Hashem to us. And therefore you need to go to a Kohen, because only if a Kohen pronounces the person to be a Metzora has he then formally received that censure in heaven's name. And it's for that very reason that he only becomes a Metzora from the time the Kohen pronounces him as a Metzora, because that's when the Cherem has been announced and now the halachas of Tzara'as are initiated. And so we see from putting all of these halachas together in as Rav Leib Mintzberg does in such a natural way, I could say, it's really just seeing the collage that emerges from all of these numerous halachas to get a sense of what Metzora is. And now, of course, we understand why it is absolutely unacceptable for a person to endeavor to remove the symptoms of tzara'as in any way other than the way the Torah prescribes. This is not just, quote-unquote, being a state of impurity. It is not even just, quote-unquote, being in a difficult situation or in an afflicted or distressing situation. He's received a message directly from Shamayim in the form of these tzara'as symptoms, and therefore he's not allowed to reject that message of censure by simply hiding the evidence or removing the evidence or such like. And as his final comment here, and Rav Leib Mintzberg, of course, the whole of Chazal is open before him. There is a very interesting, and we rarely have occasion to speak about it, but an interesting discussion in Maseches Brachos and Daf Hei. And Maseches Brachos and Daf Hei is a daf that talks about suffering. And on the first Amud, it talks about suffering in a way that perhaps we could try and relate to. It atones for sins, and etc. and so forth. But then the Gemara proceeds to talk about a concept called Yisurin Shel Ahava, suffering of love. It quotes a pasuk in Mishlei, "Es Asher Yehav Hashem Yochiach," the one that Hashem loves, he will again censure, sometimes with yisurim. A very challenging concept, especially for us in our milieu, where sometimes it seems that the the aim to be comfortable is it becomes a religion in itself, so that any type of discomfort is couldn't possibly be seen in any meaningful context. And yet the Gemara says sometimes there's this idea where a person receives suffering and they're a sign of love. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants to purify him just that one drop more. And there's many side discussions of Yisurim Shel Ahava, and within the course of that discussion, the Gemara says, one thing you should know, it makes a point of saying this, Negoim Einam Yisurim Shel Ahava. Tzaras is never Yisurim Shel Ahava. It's a very interesting thing to make a point of saying. Tzaras can be uncomfortable, but it's never Yisurim Shel Ahava. Why are these afflictions different than any others? Says Rav Leib Mintzberg, now we understand. If the whole essence of tzaras is receiving a censure from heaven, that can never be Yisurin Shel Ahava, a person who's on these rarefied levels where he's doing just fine and these afflictions are purifying all the more. Tzaras means you're not doing just fine. There are chronic issues. You're not in the zone for Yisurin Shel Ahava. And that, of course, fits in perfectly with the discussion as we've understood it. So I think a very interesting and important way of bringing many of the elements of tzaras together. Let's take a look at the different types of tzaras. We're not going to go through all of them. In fact, we'll go through really just a few of them in the beginning of Perek Yud Gimel. Yud Gimel Pasuk Beis. And this will be our final discussion for the evening. So what does the Pasuk say? Once again, Perek Yud Gimel Pasuk Beis. Adam, if there is a person, Kiyev or Besaro, if he has in the skin of his flesh, Se'es, O Sapachas, O Baheres, if he has these three whitish discolorations in his flesh, called Se'es, Sapachas, and Baheres. Vayob or Besaro Lenega Tzaras, and it will be in the skin of his flesh an affliction of Tzaras, he should be brought to the Kohen. What exactly is Se'es and Sapachas and Baheres? Not so easy. There's halachas about them, different forms of white. There are numerous forms of white. But exactly how the translation gets you to from one to the other, so that's one needs to work quite hard to understand that matter. In fact, I opened up the art scroll and they rendered these three terms, Se'es, Sapachas and Baheres, as transliterated terms, Se'es, Sapachas, and Baheres. So, on the positive side, nothing was lost in translation. Let's put it that way. But it's just a symptom of the how difficult it is to translate. Either way, difficult types of white. The Mishnayos, of course, is the Masechta, Maseches Negoim, that discusses all these things. But I would like to make reference to a comment of the Medrash. Medrash by Yikra Rabba at the end of Parshas Tazria. And the Medrash takes this whole verse, completely expanding it. As we know, and in fact we referred to last week, the four exiles that we were and are destined to go through, Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome, says the Medrash, these four exiles are referred to or alluded to in these four terms. Se'es, if we go back from the beginning, Se'es, says the Medrash, Zegolos Bavel, that's the Babylonian exile. Sapachas, the second term is the second exile, ze golus paras. Baheres, the third term is golus yavan. And the fourth term in the verse, negat saras, ze golus romi. So before you look around, these four types of tzaras have become the four exiles. And comments of the Medrash like this deserve extra special care and attention, because it cannot be that whenever there's four things in the verse and there's four exiles, so to start making shiduchim between them, and these four or these four. And I personally think that a person who has tzaras, I think he's got enough on his head. He doesn't need to be told that he's coming down with a classic case of Persian exile or the like. I don't know what the what's the prescription, you know? Take 70 years and see me in the morning. So what exactly is the point of these associations? And just in case we think it couldn't get any more confounding, it does. Because the truth of the matter is, there aren't really four terms in the verse. The verse talks about se'es, sapachas, baheres, and then it says v'haya b'or b'sarona negat tzaras, and it will be an affliction of tzaras. So the fourth term is not a fourth category; it's just any of the above three categories. So while we've got our hands full trying to understand how the four terms match up with the four exiles, we need to contend with the fact that there aren't even four of them. There's three. With a verdict, with a result. The Shem Yishmuel of Sokachov explains. And it's based on a section of the Maharal in his Sefer Ner Mitzvah, which is Maharal Sefer on Hanukkah. The concept of Golus, and we see it's such a historic concept. It's not just historical, it's historic in the sense that it almost seems that it's part of Jewish destiny to go through these four exiles. They're not like each other, and they're not just, quote-unquote, a matter of a hostile nation oppressing the Jewish people. It's much more than that. Each of the exiles represents a corruption of a human faculty that could lead a person totally astray. What do we mean by that? Maharal explains that there are three elements that make up a human being. And one could call them a number of things, but he calls them physical life, and then nefesh life force life, and then soul. Guf, nefesh, and neshama. What does that mean before we allow things to get abstract or elusive? Guf is physical living, everything that's involved in physical living, physical drives and such like. That's a part of human living. On top of that, you have what's called nefesh, which we could call personality. It's beyond physical living. It's interactions, things like jealousy and pride and such like, and loyalty and all of these things. And then the third level is the level of seichel or neshama, the intellect. If it helps illustrate, one could say that the pyramid of life is very illuminating here. Because the lowest level, physical life, is actually shared by human beings with animals and plants. Anything that's alive has physical life. It grows, it consumes, it reproduces. It's everything that we call physical life also exists to some degree within the plant world and within the animal world. That's level number one. Level number two, what we call personality, also exists within the animal world. Again, the notions that we mentioned, loyalty, territory, jealousy, ascendancy, and all of these things. The alpha male is an animal concept. And then at the top of the pyramid, you have a uniquely human faculty, which is the intellect in the abstract and speculative sense. Each of the Golios, each of the three exiles, represents a corruption of one of these faculties, turning it into something that is celebrated for itself, that's pursued for itself as an ideal. And that needs to be confronted by the Jewish people. It's embodied by one of the exiling nations. It needs to be confronted, seen through, and overcome by the Jewish people. And where do we see this? Well, Bavel, Babylon, represents the corruption of nefesh. That is to say, the pursuit of ascendancy. Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon, the Havdil, Babylon remains nowadays as any type of sense of delusions of grandeur. It's Nebuchadnezzar who says, Edame le'elyon, I will be analogous to the one on high, looking to conquer the world and looking to be on top of the world. That's what Bavel represents. And that is a corruption of the faculty of nefesh, what we could call, or what is called, the will to power. A corruption of the will to power, a celebration of the will to power. Persia didn't that do that much in terms of world ascendancy. It more or less kept things, if it didn't even lose them. But it's more a celebration of physical living. That's why Megillas Esther, that we just emerged from, is practically a series of parties. I mean, whoever's in charge is using whatever power they have to enjoy themselves and to indulge physically as much as they can. And that becomes their goal in life. And that is a corruption of the faculty of guf, of physical living, the will to pleasure. And finally, you have Greece. And Greece, Yavon, of course, celebrates the faculty of intellect. They're the ones who develop in a way that no one ever did before. Philosophy, thoughts about life, etc. That's how a person achieves their greatness. And those are these three. They are the centralization and idealization of these three faculties for themselves, and not as a vehicle for higher living. Part of the Golos experience is to be confronted by how ugly that can become, and realize that these are not things to be celebrated in themselves. They need to lead a person higher. Now, we've spoken so far about three exiles. There's only three faculties. But what about the fourth exile? Says Maharal, the fourth exile is all of the above in ever-changing permutations and combinations. And Rome, as we know, the Roman Empire conquered the world before, more than from east to west. They brought back the physical indulgences for which they were famous, and philosophically they were the heirs of Greece. Not many chidushim, one could say. No one speaks of Roman philosophy, not in a complimentary way. And therefore, they take all of the above, and that is why the Gaulus of Rome is considered, has in historically outlasted all the other three put together. Because when these three faculties combine, it takes that much more, exponentially more, to overcome it. But we see that the fourth exile of Rome is equal to any and all of the above. And it's very interesting that the Medrash also discusses this. Daniel, in his vision of the four beasts, which represent the four exiles, the Medrash says he had these visions over the course of two evenings. On the first evening, he saw the first three, and on the second evening, he saw the fourth. Now, the division of four into two evenings would naturally be two and two, but it isn't two and two. It's three and one. To teach you, says the Medrash, that the fourth exile is equal to all of the three. And what's fascinating for us, if we again just refer to our discussion of last week, where we saw that the four beasts that have one kosher sign also correspond to the four exiles. Well, how are they portrayed? These beasts are spoken about twice in the Torah. Firstly, in last week's parsha, Shmini. But they're reviewed again in Chumash Devarim, in Parshas Re'eh, where the laws of Kashrus are reviewed. And when they're reviewed, it's not exactly the same. How so? Because in last week's parsha, each of these four beasts is discussed in a separate verse. There's one verse which says the camel is like this. And the second verse says, and the shafan is like this. And the third verse says, the arneves is like this. And the fourth verse talks about the chazir. Four beasts, four verses. And corresponding to the four exiles, that's exactly what they were, four exiles. But if we move forward to Chumash Devarim, we will see that when it goes back over them, it says the camel, the shafan, and the arnevis are like this. I mean, they have the same characteristic. All those three are put in verse 1, and then the chazir, the pig, is in verse 2. And what does this show us? It gives us two perspectives on the four exiles. On the one hand, they're four, 1, 2, 3, 4. But on the other hand, they're really two. The first three and the second one. The division of these beasts in these two ways gives us this dual perspective on these four exiles. And what does this have to do with Tsaras? To come back to our Mitzora. A person, as we said, as we saw before, the Tsaras is a censure. There's something about this person's life which is out of control. It's being abused. And it could be any of these faculties. It could be the faculty of guf, of physical living. It could be nefesh, personality living. It could be seichel, is intellectual living. It could be any of the above. And that is why, if we go back again, and again, consult your local Mishnah for the different shades of white. But look at these three terms. Once again, in verse 2, Se'es, Sapachas, and Vaheres. What is Se'es? The word Se'es comes from the word raised up, like Kisisa or Nesias Kapayim. Because Se'es is a person who insists on being above all others. And that can lead him to Tsaras. Se'es. Above all, Ibra Alas, says the Medrash, that's Golas Bavel. Golas Bavel, as a nation, is a corruption of the faculty of ascendancy, like Nebuchadnezzar. And this person has an element of that in his personal life. And that's why Se'es, the will to ascendancy, that's Golas Bavel. What's the second term? Sapachas. What is Sapachas? Well, we're in a Shemitah year. We know what Sfichin are. Sfichin are things that grow wild, uncultivated, untended to. It's just pure physical growth. And maybe that's what's happening to this person. His physical living is in excess and it's out of control. It's not cultivated. It's not in any way regulated. And maybe it's even celebrated. Sapachas, he's like Sfichin, grows wild. Physical growth, says the Medrash, that's Golas Paras. Paras as a nation is a corruption of physical living. And what's the third term? Baheres. And what does Bahir mean? Bahir means illuminated. Sefer Lahavdil, Sefer HaBahir, illumination. Because perhaps a person is in investing and idealizing their personal illumination or enlightenment in a way which is self-destructive. It's a corruption of the third faculty, the faculty of Seichel. That's Golas Yovan, a corruption of the faculty of Seichel. And then what? What's left? We're done. But there's another phrase in the Pasuk. V'haya b'or b'saro l'nega tsaras. And it will be an affliction of tsaras. Now, what is Negat Saras? Is it a fourth category? No. It's any of the above, says the Medrash. That's right. That's Golas Rome. Any of the above. In the same way that Rome itself takes all of the above in different permutations, as we said, and combinations, and continues to launch them at a person, it's not a fourth category. It's all of the above, and it's more than the sum of its parts. That's Negat Saras. It's not a fourth category, just like Golas Ra. And that's the message of the Medrash. And really what the Medrash is saying is, it's taking and it's doing a really an incredible thing. The national experience that we call Golas is not as detached from personal experience as we might think. Because what those nations represent can often be very similar to what an individual can undergo. And I think there's an amazing message also, as we move towards thinking about redemption, because if in the end the stuff of which the Tsaras is made, and the stuff of which Golas is made, and don't forget, the Metzora goes into Golus. He undergoes his personal Golus experience. He's sent out of town. He's exiled from town. Because national Golus is really a national iteration of personal Golus. But if that's true, then perhaps national iteration, that national redemption, pardon me, is a mass iteration of personal redemption. In the sense that as we, as good Jews, hopefully looking to bring the redemption, it's a redemption for the Jewish nation. What can we do for the nation? Well, firstly, the answer is plenty. But part of what the Medrash is teaching us is the nation is made up of individuals. And if the golus is too much of what's going wrong, then each individual who tries to make these things right, even in their own experience, for most of us, it's only we have our individual sphere, our sphere of influence and our circle, etc. It's not national for both of us, but it's significant. And if enough individuals impact their sphere in that way, that's the stuff of which redemption is made. And this, I think, is a wonderful message which comes out. Again, the halachas of Tzaras are many, detailed, and varied. And yet the enduring message that comes out is nothing less than the path towards Geula for the klal, for the am, and for the individuals who care about the am, to put themselves in order as individuals, not to underestimate the significance of the contribution that could make to the am. And the more people that do that, the more we have the am on its way towards Geula, the culmination and realization of which we should see b'mehira b'yamin. Amen.